I want to start this morning's service by recalling together the story of A Christmas Carol. Who is Scrooge?
Miser.
He was a miser. Tell me more about the story.
Very poor employer.
Poor employer. Poor employment practices. Yes? What did he do? What was that? He didn't allow unions. He was a cynic, someone said. Unhappy man. What? Has watched other people's email.
He missed opportunities for happiness in his life.
He missed opportunities for happiness in his life. He was a very unhappy person. Lonely.
Unloving
person, yes. Mean? Very wealthy, though. Who is Mr. Cratchit? His employee, his clerk. Long-suffering. Meek. Cold, yes. He loved his family, and he had a son, right? Tiny Tim. What else do we need to know about this story? He got a second chance. How did he do that? He did a lot of dreaming. Was that called re-education? An attitude adjustment, yes. In the ministerial world, we would call that praxis and reflection. He got to do some introspection and change himself. Say again? We'll leave the politics out for the moment. I think you're right, though. He had a conversion experience, absolutely. And this was... And then he was filled with joy, yes. He had an epiphany. Right. Okay, I think we know this story. It's very popular. In his older age, Dickens would go around and do readings of the Christmas Carol, and of course we still do that sometimes. Here's Dickens describing Mr. Scrooge. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone. Scrooge, a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. Hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire. Secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster. The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his thin lips blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. A frosty rime was on his head, and on his eyebrows, and his wiry chin. He carried his own low temperature always about with him. He iced his office in the dog days and didn't thaw it 1 degree for Christmas. But the story A Christmas Carol is a story of an idealized celebration, what with the family gathering for the turkey dinner and giving to charity. The story itself had a huge influence on how we celebrate Christmas today. At the time, Christmas as a celebration was waning. It had been a drunken public revel with not much family emphasis at all. It was the vestiges of the Roman Saturnalia solstice celebration. The Industrial Revolution was in full swing, and the poor were very poor indeed. And the laws kept it that way. There was no social safety net at all. Dickens' story, and Dickens' other works as well, shed light on the plight of the poor, and consequently some slight modifications came about. Christmas was the first statutory holiday. But the story itself was written as a result of Dickens' need of money, desperately needed money. In the fall of 1843, he and his wife, Kate, were expecting their fifth child. Requests for money from his family, a large mortgage on his house, and lagging sales from the monthly installments of his current cereal had left him quite short of cash. The The seeds for the story that became A Christmas Carol were planted in Dickens' mind during a trip to Manchester, where he delivered a speech in support of adult education for the manufacturing workers there. The need for education to remedy crime and poverty, along with scenes he had recently witnessed at one of the so-called ragged schools, which had no books and were only taught orally, caused Dickens to resolve to, quote, strike a sledgehammer blow for the poor. As a child of 12, Dickens had worked in a blacking factory gluing labels to jars because his father was in debtor's prison and, of course, couldn't work while he was there. He was there because he had debts. Debtor's prisons, to me, don't make any sense. They're backwards. And the rest of his family lived in prison with him, but Dickens got to work in a factory. That time in the factory was humiliating for him and changed his life. His own education was curtailed when his father lost a subsequent job. So he was self-taught from the age of 15, and he continued to fight for improved social conditions all his life. And part of that time, he was associated with Unitarian churches. We learn from Dickens, and especially A Christmas Carol, that the holidays are, quote, a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time. The only time I know of, he says, in the long calendar of the year when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut-up hearts freely and to think of other people below them as if they were really fellow passengers to the grave and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. This was what Dickens described for the rest of his life as a carol philosophy. It's how we accomplish this giving of gifts that I want to address this morning. Debt and credit are the topics of Margaret Atwood's recent Massey lecture series. The whole theology of Christianity, Atwood says, rests on the notion of spiritual debts and what must be done to repay them and how you might get out of paying by having someone else pay instead. Well, see, the Jesus or the devil, right? Capitalism was exploding onto the scene in 19th century as Dickens was writing. Some people could get very rich without working in the traditional sense very hard. They didn't do any pounding or digging or building or something. So had some other hand helped them along? What kind of payment was due as a consequence? That hand could be the hand of God. Think of the Protestant work ethic. If you work hard, you'll do well. And think of how many people have made pacts with the devil, whether in folklore or reality. Sell your soul and you'll get the money to live in luxury. To whom do you owe your debts? Is your credit card a blessing or a curse? I can't answer that one for you. Maybe it depends on how you use your credit or whether it uses you. Maybe that's why it's called usury. Dawn's puns are contagious. Scrooge undergoes an overnight conversion. He ends up by giving away the biggest turkey to be found and much else besides. He pays his moral debt to society for being a rich person. Dickens believes that people who have more money have a moral obligation to help those less fortunate. University of Tennessee professor Richard Kelly puts it this way. A Christmas Carol is built upon numerous contrasts, rich and poor, warmth and cold, plenty and hunger, family and loneliness, generosity and miserliness, affection and cruelty, dream and reality, freedom and compulsion, past and present and future. Most of those opposing forces are recapitulated within Scrooge himself. The cold-hearted, compulsive, lonely, miserly man who eats his abstemious meal in the shadows emerges from his dreams, memories, and fears into a generous, fun-loving, warm, caring, fatherly man. The texture of the story, rich with contrasting imagery, prepares the reader for Scrooge's conversion well in advance of the concluding chapter. True, this is hardly a realistic tale. Indeed, it resembles a fable, but it renders a powerful psychological account of the fruits of introspection. Kelly continues, The three stages of Scrooge's conversion, the detailed memories of a lonely childhood, an awakened vision of the suffering and joys of those presently around him, and his fear of future loneliness and an awareness of his own mortality, combine to change him into a decent man, one who goes on to earn from those who knew him this crowning accolade. It was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well, if any man alive possessed that knowledge. Part of how we now keep Christmas is the giving of gifts. There's a reciprocal relationship between giver and recipient, just as there is between debtor and creditor. Neither can exist without the other. I go back to Margaret Visser's The Gift of Thanks volume again. She talks about gifts and the social rituals we engage in around them. Gifts may well be mundane items like clothing or other essentials, but we make them special by wrapping them up in sparkly or brightly colored paper, then tying them up with a ribbon, or at least putting a bow on them. The wrapping is testament to the trouble we have gone to in selecting or making them. I have sometimes wrapped my presents in the colored comics, and I found out that sometimes the recipients were less than impressed. I knew I was flouting convention, but I hadn't quite realized that I was devaluing my own present in doing this, just based on the wrapping paper. I thought I was being ecologically responsible. If the gift needs protection, that would come afterwards with mailing paper and twine. The pretty paper itself might need protection. Often we carefully display the wrapped gifts under the Christmas tree. In our household, the rather few gifts quietly appear, and the other one's supposed to notice when they do. Al never shakes or hefts them. I always do. I think he thinks it's not quite okay to do that, but I do it anyway. Because much of the fun is trying to guess what it might be. Books can be sort of obvious when they're wrapped up, but other things are not so. The guessing and the speculating are part of the ritual, part of the fun for me. When it comes time to open your gifts, there's often a particular way to do it, different from family to family, depending on your tradition. Maybe the youngest or the oldest one hands them out to the gathered family. Maybe they are opened one at a time, or like when I was a kid, it was a free-for-all all at once. It's all about timing, all about your pattern. Timing is another piece. When do you open your gifts? I grew up opening them on Christmas Eve. Al did it on Christmas morning. We had to find a common place. So for a long time, we did do it on Christmas morning. But now that we often drive away somewhere on Christmas morning, we usually do it Christmas Eve after the service. The rules of the Christmas gift game vary somewhat from family to family. If there are no dollar limits set, usually we're supposed to know that they're supposed to be somehow equivalent, even though we're maybe not really sure what the other person's going to give us. It gets difficult when you don't know what they're going to give you. Perhaps that is why I have mostly refused to engage in the gift game in my family. My brother's delighted. He has no clue either what to get people. My sister is bewildered, though, by this refusal to engage in gift giving. She needs to gift presents. She yearns for the connection that the gifts so concretely represent. Giving gifts imposes a kind of obligation on the recipient. Either you reciprocate in an equivalent kind of way, or you are beholden to your benefactor. You have to be grateful at the very least. And I say, send thank you notes. I think that's part of why I gave up. A gift is not part of a written contract where the terms are specified. You may not be sure of the gift's value or exactly what kind of return is expected. Visser speculates that one reason we reciprocate is that we can feel inferior for having received a gift and wish to equalize the relationship. And so if we do not reciprocate, we lose status. And the gifts hang about the house reminding us about this. Certainly gifts reinforce the fact of a relationship. So this year, I have made some gifts for my family, some quilted potholders. I do hope that they will remind my family of me occasionally. Since I bought nothing to make them, it was all leftover material from previous projects, the monetary value is negligible. The thought will have to count. Part of the gift-giving ritual is knowing the recipient well enough to know what they want or need. And that's hard these days when my family lives all a long ways from me. I'm hoping that these gifts might be both decorative and useful. I guess those are my criteria for a gift. We are definitely into the shopping season. I assume that you will be buying or making presents to present in their due time. I hope these musings on gifts have given you a little bit more awareness of the role gifts play in your relationships. Perhaps you will be more mindful of why you are buying what and for whom this year. I will close with this affirmation of the value of Christmas by Dickens. It is his nephew speaking to the unreformed Scrooge. There are many things from which I might have derived good, by which I have not profited, I dare say, returned the nephew. Christmas among the rest. But I am sure I have always thought of Christmas time, when it has come round, apart from the veneration due to its sacred name and origin, if anything belonging to it can be apart from that. I've always thought of Christmas time as a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time, the only time I know of in the long calendar of the year when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut-up hearts freely and to think of people below them as if they were really fellow passengers to the grave and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. And therefore, Uncle, though it has never put a scrap of gold or silver in my pocket, I believe that it has done me good and will do me good, and I say, God bless it. Amen.